I do have the great pleasure of engaging in conversation with Mohamed Alerian. We will not be talking about the weather, which is forecast to become dismal here over the next few days. We will not be talking about Brexit, which is pretty dismal too. We will instead focus mainly on emerging markets and their perspective on the global economy and markets. But I expect we'll also have some time for some further discussion of low for long interest rates. Now, Mohamed, after doing a PhD in Oxford, some years after me, I have to say, Mohamed spent 15 years at the IMF and then 20 years in the financial sector. He has now returned to the academic institution where he did his undergraduate degree, but with a somewhat more elevated status, shall we say, as president of Queen's College, Cambridge. I can assure the students that he will be much more approachable than that august title suggests, as soon as it'll be safe for us to approach anybody. Now, let me start specifically with a question about emerging economies. Mohamed, how do we explain that there have been very few financial accidents in emerging economies so far recently, despite the significant deterioration in the external environment facing them?
You know, first of all, Richard, thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to be with everybody. And I've really enjoyed listening this afternoon, and I took quite a few notes. When you look at emerging markets during the last 9 months, it's been very much like Charles Dickens' Tale of Two Cities, the best of world and the worst of world. You would have expected more accidents because of the worst of worlds. And the worst of world included lower export receipts, virtually no tourism receipts, lower remittances, lower foreign direct investment. And the typical emerging economy has at least two or three of these four sources of revenues as a really important source. So you would have expected more accidents. But really, we've gotten very, very few. And the reason for that is that it's been the best of worlds on financing. If you've had access to the capital markets, you've been able to issue a lot very cheaply. Not because you're particularly attractive. It's not an absolute attractiveness. It's a relative attractiveness. You're a lot more attractive to everything else for the reasons we've heard all this afternoon, which is these very, very low rates for long. If you don't have access to the capital markets, the IMF has responded much faster than ever before. And the international community has responded much faster than any before with debt service suspension, the DSSI initiative. So what you've lost on the real economy side, you've gained on the financial side. Now, to go back to what Ellen said, the challenge is going to be for G to be greater than R, for these countries to be able to generate the sort of economic growth needed to accommodate the much higher debt stock that they've taken on.
But R is going to be very low for a long time, no? So
yeah, I worry about the G side of it, and not just for emerging economies. I worry about the G side of it for the advanced world as well. I think that the scarring involved here may mean that it's much higher to get back to proper growth than we currently think it is.
Even with these external flows into these economies, which could be invested in profitable export-generating, et cetera, activity.
They could, but you've got to be able to sell to somebody. So we do have a sort of macro issue, a global economy issue, which is it is not clear who your locomotive of growth are going to be. Right now, China and Asia certainly is a locomotive of growth. They're going to show some positive numbers and otherwise pretty scary 2020 growth outlook. But there too, you have to ask the question, do they have enough oomph, if you like, based just on domestic demand? Because it's going to take a lot longer for Europe to recover. It also will take a lot longer for the U.S. to recover.
So you're seeing a significant continued fall off in world trade and exports of these economies?
So I'm seeing a few things. I think if you look at the demand component, it is not going to come back as quickly as before. Two, is we're going to have three sources of deglobalization coming together. and changing the nature of globalization. We're going to have, first, a lot of trade friction. I think once, and you know this, Rich, than I do, once you weaponize tariffs and investment regulation, it's very difficult to de-weaponize them. And we have weaponized them in the last few years. Secondly, businesses that I talk to are putting resilience now ahead of efficiency, or at least putting greater emphasis on resilience. Part of that is looking at these very efficient, just-in-time, cross-border supply chains and making them more robust, which is localizing some of this. That's going to be a deglobalization trend. And then finally, there will be pushback from people. We have seen a massive increase in inequality, not just inequality of income and wealth, but inequality of opportunity. And that will have a deglobalization flavor in some advanced economies. So it's not just that demand will be less, but there will be a shift to meeting more of that demand from internal sources than from exports.
I'm a little bit skeptical about the story that supply chains will be repatriated in a sense. There are huge fixed costs in doing that. You've got to be pretty sure that the world is going to be unfavorable in a sense to your existing supply chains and that they'll be particularly risky. You've got to be pretty sure about that to justify changing these patterns, which, as I say, are, you know, there's a lot of fixed costs built into them, no?
Yeah, and I think you have to, you know, when we say that, people think, oh, they're going to completely dismantle this and they're going to build something. But you and I know that you cannot replace something with nothing. So this is not about dismantling. This is about where the incremental investment goes. That's the first issue. So as the incremental investment goes, people will diversify. Secondly, I love asking the question to multinational, and you must have asked that. What are you thinking about China, for example? In the context not just of the shock we've just had, but also of the growing trade tension, of this notion that the dual option model that a lot of companies and countries have followed is going to be more problematic. And they say, in China for China. So very few multinationals are looking to abandon China, but also the emphasis now is you produce in China for China, and you no longer assume that you're producing in China for the rest of the world. So you're going to see a change in emphasis. These are multi-year shifts. And this notion we have that you dismantle everything today and create something else, well, that's not going to happen because of the reasons you cite. But look at the delta as opposed to the existing stock.
Is China, take China, which you can't avoid, is China, though, going to be entirely happy with firms investing just for the Chinese market and not at all for export?
So China has signaled very clearly, okay, its realization that the old model where the advanced economies are in the middle, you, China, are in the periphery, and you supply have that relationship, is changing. And what's changing is China's looking to create more and more links, A, that go around the advanced economies, and B, that link up the periphery much more. And I see this in not only how they conduct trade, I see this not only in the payments systems they put in place, the bilateral payment system, in new institutions, but also in this incredible agility to take advantage of opportunities. So remember, we talked first about mask diplomacy. We're now talking about vaccine diplomacy. And what you see is China is increasingly putting emphasis on let's create pipes around the advanced economies because the pipes to the advanced economies are becoming less reliable.
This is taking us a bit away from our subject, but I can't resist, given what you just said about payments and so forth, can't resist asking about your view about China in the international financial system, and in particular, the role of the RMB going forward. You think it's likely to be a serious major world currency in the next decade, say?
So it depends what you mean by major world currency. Will it look, act, and behave like the dollar? No. Will it become much more important in bilateral trading arrangements? Yes. Already, a lot of these bilateral trading arrangements don't settle in dollars.
So,
that it's going to become more important, but it will not be as a reserve currency.
And not in financial markets.
Currency used increasingly in bilateral relationships.
And as I said, not in financial markets.
Correct.
Which is really central to the international currency role, if you like. Let me continue a bit with emerging markets and go back to our low for long theme and ask, overall, has low for long and the search for yield been a good thing for the emerging markets?
Short term, it has been a good thing because it pushes, it literally pushes capital to the emerging world. And it pushes capital to the emerging world because people are looking for, quote, yield pickup. But we've learned a few things. You know, we've had quite a few bouts of these things. We've learned a few things. One is that the ability of countries to absorb that capital efficiently varies a great deal, a great deal. And in some cases, it is absorbed in a very inefficient manner. So you cannot translate financial flows into increased productive capabilities. Second, the nature of the investor matters. I call this tourist dollars as opposed to resident dollars. And the image I always have, because, you know, remember, I manage money both for dedicated fund and within PIMCO for crossover fund. And they behave completely differently. The dedicated fund has raised money for the purpose of investing in emerging markets. It is a resident investor. The crossover fund is more visiting until something better comes along or until a risk appears that it could no longer absorb within its mandate and therefore departs. And we have a structural imbalance in emerging markets where the crossover money is much bigger than the dedicated money. So the dedicated money cannot step up to the plate when all the tourists leaves. That is very important to understand because it's an asset class that will overshoot on the way up, and it will overshoot on the way down because these technicals become the price setter. And there's really good theoretical reason why that happens. It's simply not appreciated enough when people look at who is investing in emerging markets.
What does this mean for exchange rates and for the, in particular, emerging markets going forward? These capital flows have pushed their exchange rates up somewhat. Is it likely that that they're going to stay at that level? And I'm not talking about short-term forecasting. None of us can forecast exchange rates in the short term, at least nobody I know. But in the medium term, do we see an overall appreciation of emerging markets rates relative to, say, the dollar, and dollar longer-term depreciation against those markets?
So that has been the view in markets for the last 4 to 5 years. And I have been sort of on the other side of that view. And the reality is, if you had invested on that view, you are disappointed today. In fact, this year is the first year, and the last few months is the first time you've really outperformed, but it has local currency emerging markets has not been a great friend for investors, even though you've had that effect. Why? Because there's so much else going on that impact the exchange rate. And understanding that and the hit you're getting on the balance of payment is something influencing exchange rate. The way countries use the exchange rate as a shock absorber also plays in. So if you are just looking at it on just that very limited view, you are capturing a very small part of the picture. I think, Richard, the most stunning thing for me is you've had massive depreciation in the exchange rate without things breaking. Turkey, Argentina, South Africa. It is truly remarkable how much these currencies have moved, and we haven't had the normal breakage that you expect when these currencies do move like that, given what happened in the past.
Yes, I think that goes back to the question of why we haven't seen as much disruption in emerging markets as we might have expected to see. And there are some real puzzles out there. But let me shift gear a bit and stay with emerging markets in a way, but try to bring that in with our low for long theme, in particular looking at demographics. One story about the downward trend in real rates since the mid-1980s is that it was due to the integration of China and other low-income countries into the world economy, this huge reserve of labor, low-cost labor, that meant a big increase in the effective labor supply to the global economy, which then lowered the relative price of labor in the aggregate and led to a fall in investment because labor was substituting for capital. Okay. Now you might think that partly because of aging in China, partly because a lot of that labor surplus has been absorbed by growth in these economies, not just China, but other low-income countries, that reserve army of labor, if you like, has been exhausted, and that it's going to turn around, and that investment will have to go up to make up for a labor shortage overall in the global economy, and hence interest rates will go up. What do you think about that picture?
So I could certainly tell that story, and that story is consistent with a few things we heard today. It is consistent with, and I have the numbers here, 55% of the responders to the poll earlier today thought inflation expectations were going to go up. It is consistent with Ellen Ray, I loved her presentation, by the way, about the notion of the intersection between structural trends and the boom-bust cycle. But what I thought was really interesting, Richard, is what it's inconsistent with. And that is that 86%, and I wrote all these things down because I thought when asked, what do you think is going to happen to short real rates? I either thought they're going down or staying the same. And I think that the one thing that's underappreciated in this whole story so far today is that central banks took on many responsibilities, not by choice, by necessity, using imperfect tools. And that has resulted in quite a distortion of interest rates in addition to everything else we see. And I say that because that's not going to go away. The lower for longer, okay, applies not only to what the market will deliver, but also what central banks are committed to. You know, in the old days, central banks would look ahead and want to see inflationary trend before they stepped on the brakes. In the new days, they will want to see the whites of the eye of inflation. They'll want to actually see inflation happening, and even see inflation in the case of the Fed happening above the 2% target before we acted. That's a different policy paradigm. And it raises all sorts of questions. You know, I wrote, you had two different views. Helen pushed back very strongly on the issue, are we addicted to QE? But then we had Anil saying, and I wrote this down again, okay, that the market views the central bank put as being a put forever, quote unquote. His words, put forever, right? And that is the tension that's going to play out as we go forward as to what this lower for longer means. You know, I'm in the minority of saying that we're going to regret this in a few years' time.
Regret the behavior of the central banks?
Correct. And this is not blame because central banks have no choice. For me, the central bank has become an insurance company. Yeah. It insures us. And us has to go through the marketplace because the asset channel is the only way that can operate on this. It insures us against all sorts of risks. And they've been increasingly insuring us. And not only are they finding out that when you do that, there's both moral hazard, adverse selection, all the classic issues we know about insurance, but in addition, they're insuring a risk that's very hard to price and that's almost impossible to underwrite sustainably. They need a handoff. They need a handoff to other policymakers who can produce genuine growth. Without genuine growth, this whole insurance model becomes really problematic in a few years' time.
Well, you need genuine policymakers for that, but I'll pass over that to take it one step further. I mean, you wrote a very successful, rightly so, book on central banks, the only game in town, et cetera. Isn't this dangerous in the longer term? Okay, we had the Greenspan put in the early 2000s, and people lived with that, and maybe there was some moral hazard in that, and so on and so forth. But nobody was worried about the future of the Fed in doing that. And then we had the Fed emerge as a market maker of last resort, as well as lender of last resort. And of course, we've seen the European Central Bank do the same thing. Isn't this continued, you refer to it in a sense, this continued extension of the roles of the central bank dangerous from the point of view of its independence? That is to say that the more it does, the more politicians are going to say, it's doing too much. Wait a minute here. And we're not just talking about German politicians or the German public. We're talking about politicians in a wide range of countries and from a wide range of potentially political viewpoints. Is this a concern?
So the independence issue is a concern, but if I may, for slightly different reasons. You know, I remember back in 2012, a PIMCO colleague of mine said, this is a no-exit policy paradigm. And I said, what do you mean it's a no-exit policy paradigm? And he said, there's no way central banks will ever be able to exit it. Mm-hmm. And then I dismissed him. In 2016, I started worrying about it. And that's why I wrote the book. I thought there was a window then. Well, the two incoming leaders of the world's most influential central banks tried it, and they were both forced into a very public U-turn.
Yep.
You mentioned Christine Lagarde. Do you remember her comments about Italy?
I do.
How long did it take her to do a U-turn on those?
A few hours, approximately.
Do you remember when Powell came in? He also was humbled by the markets pretty quickly, because the markets have been conditioned to expect this unlimited support. And when you try to take it away, you get the taper tantrum of 2013,
yep,
but in a big way. And you worry about the functioning of markets. Again, what did O'Neill write? If even the treasury market can get disrupted, good luck for other markets. His words, right? So think a little bit about if you're the central bank here, you get dragged in more and more and more, and it's almost impossible to exit. So what does that mean? It means that your destiny is totally reliant on someone else. And that someone else is the policymakers who have the right tool to promote genuine, sustainable, and inclusive growth. Now, they have this problem that if you worked at the IMF like I did and dealt with a lot of countries, you realize that structural reforms are a very bad political trade-off. Most of them imply upfront costs, long-term benefits. And very few political systems like that equation. They prefer the other equation, short-term benefits, long-term cost. So ironically, the political system will allow the central banks to continue being the only game in town for much longer than the central banks want, than it's the interest of the country, et cetera. And then when it goes wrong, if it goes wrong, it is the central banks that are going to get blamed. And I think, you know, deep inside, a growing number of central bankers, you know, look at today's financial stability report from the Financial Stability Board, right? It talks about this. So, you know, it is an issue, especially now that risk has migrated from banks to non-banks and morphed in the way it has. We live every day with liquid instruments being offered on illiquid asset classes. Think about this. Is that really what we want to be doing with our financial system?
As you know, I think about it quite a lot in the context of macroprudential authority, but it's a very, very big issue. And as we were chatting about before we came on screen here, there are real questions as to whether one is happy about having investment vehicles out there that have extreme degrees of maturity transformation, extreme degrees of liquidity transformation, and which sometimes have to shut down as a result. We saw in the spring, a number of investment vehicles have to shut their gates because they couldn't deal with redemption requests. I mean, mind you, I said a number, maybe about representing about $50 billion or so of invested assets. Overall, relative to the world of asset management, that's trivial. Do you think it's a serious danger?
So I think it's a serious risk. And when people say, well, it's small, I remember 2008. I remember the whole view going into 2008, it is small. But understand what happens when contagion strikes. If you cannot sell what you want to sell, you will sell whatever you can sell. And disruptions have a way of spreading really quickly from illiquid asset classes because it forces people to do things that they need to do for liquidity. And therefore you get these contagion waves that then suck in all sorts of other sorts of behavior. I've also seen what happens when the relative mindset gives way to the absolute mindset. The relative mindset is, am I getting paid more than anything than I would be paid otherwise? And to show you how extreme this mindset has gotten, I often listen to somebody who I respect a lot as an investment manager. And that person was saying in complete seriousness, and it relates to the pressure on the 60-40 portfolio in a world of distorted asset prices, that their risk mitigating holdings have shifted from government bonds to investment grade. And now they were seriously thinking about short-dated high-yield bonds as their risk mitigator. Think about that, short-dated high-yield. Now, why did they get there? They got there because there's the notion now that the Fed has entered high-yield bonds and that the Fed will not tolerate a disruption there. So you might as well, you don't know whether the disruption will come, but in the meantime, you might as well get the additional return. And guess what? Your default risk isn't as high as it was in the past. That is quite a consequential train of thought that shows you that if risk mitigation is now extended to high yield bonds, you know, what world are we living in? And that's what worries me a lot, is that the natural consequences is more and more and more risk taking on the assumption that the insurance company will provide more and more insurance, but you cannot insure people against default. It's actually very hard to insure people against default. And capital impairment is what really is the alarm clock. So that's why we really need the real economy to come back. If the real economy comes back, central banks will look really smart.
Well, let's hope. Let's hope that that'll be the case. Let me take a question from the audience, which is the following. I have William Chung from Allianz Global Investors. Indeed, you may know, I don't know, but William says, do you think that the disparity in fiscal and monetary policies between advanced economies and emerging economies will cause any structural change in emerging economies?
So I don't know William, and if I knew him well, I would have said, don't ask such difficult questions.
I think they'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah, you know, there's many, many, many surprises of this crisis. And one of them is that developing countries have been able to do things that once were thought unthinkable. You know, normally when you have a global crisis, you don't expect your typical emerging economy to have the fiscal and monetary space to stimulate. That's not typically what happens. Typically what happens is they have to tighten their belt even more. That's not what happened this time around. And as I said, there's good reasons for that because funding was ample on that. But there's also a big difference, as you know, Richard, and I'm sure as William knows, to use game theoretic terms, between a one-round game and a multi-round game. What emerging economies did works in a one-round game. What they did does not work if it turns out to be a multi-round game. And that's why it's really important to figure out how long is this journey to economic normality. Now, if you're the US and you have the political will, which they don't right now, but you can play this multi-round game of stimulating. Certainly the central banks, the ECB and the Fed can do it for a while. It's not the case for most emerging economies. So where are you going to see this whole issue of fiscal and monetary policy and what does it mean going forward is if it turns out to be a multi-round game. And that goes back to the vaccine. It goes back how quickly will it be available. There's all sorts of issues. We had great news over the last two Mondays, but there's still quite a journey to when we get to that destination.
A lot of what's important in repeated games is reputation. And what the reputation of a government or of a central bank is in the markets and for its own people. But that would take us a little too far from our field right now. Let me go back to something that Alain brought up on a slide earlier this afternoon, a piece of recent research that finds that historically pandemics have been followed almost always by a quite long 10 to 20 year period of low real interest rates. Do you have any views on how the COVID pandemic is likely to affect rates over the next 5 and 10 years? I mean, is this just historical evidence, just an accident, or can we see some underlying structural reasons for it?
So I was really intrigued by that, and I have to go back and look more at the research. And I was intrigued because I would love to look at the pandemics during prior periods of globalization. Mm-hmm. And let me say why. Because on the demand side for me, yeah, that makes total sense. You know, what does a pandemic do? It alters perception of human counterparty risk. That's what it does first and foremost. That's what a pandemic is, okay? Is that you and I can no longer trust each other. And just like what happens when financial counterparty risk goes up, the right reaction to that is to step back. And in stepping back, you turn short-term problems into long-term problems, right? You decimate the service industry. The restaurant shuts down. You know, so there is a sort of secular stagnation element to it, which is important. The other thing that happens during pandemics is because they are tail events, they increase household economic insecurity. So when you look at these two factors, they actually depress interest rates for a while. So that bit I understand fully. What I don't quite understand is what do you do if you have a reverse productivity shock? And you disagreed with the possibility of having that reserve productivity shock. So I have to respect that you can't take it for granted. But we're seeing a significant increase in firm concentration go on. Will that mean different price behaviors or not? I don't know. But what I do know is the strong have that in the corporate world, the strong have gotten stronger and the weak have gotten weaker. And we're seeing a hollowing out of the mid-sized companies, because it's become very difficult to live in that space. Either you are a boutique player or you are increasingly a big supermarket sort of approach to that. So I don't know whether this time around we're going to have the same behavior, because I'm not so sure about the supply side. But I think from the demand side, it makes total sense.
I'm looking now at questions from the audience again, and seeing that one question asking about term premiums and inflation expectations. Do you have any views on why the term premium seems to have trended downwards over the past decade? I mean, the term premium on government bonds, whether they be U.S. treasuries or British treasuries or Bund or the 10-year German and 2-year German, you have the same phenomenon, it appears everywhere. And it has been a trend. Why should that happen?
Because of investor behavior. So, you know, again, a PIMCO colleague, Scott Mather, sort of very early on said, look at the Japanese yield curve. Look what happened to the Japanese yield curve as a forward indicator. And what you saw is cascading lower yields and the term premium happen over time. And basically, part of that is you're pushing investors out the maturity curve. You know, there's a whole bunch of investors who cannot get away from interest rate risk. They'd like to, but they can't. They can't dabble in credit risk to a large extent. They can't dabble in other sorts of liquidity risk. They can't. So what they do is they try to extend the maturities as central banks lower short-term rates. So the lower for longer policy rate, the greater the pressure that goes out the yield curve, as long as you don't get a disruption. And that's exactly what happened in Japan. You know, when we look at the Japanese last decades, they were relatively stable, right? They were stable with something that wasn't what the Japanese wanted, but they were relatively stable. And when you get stability, as you know, Richard, in the financial world, you take on incremental risk. The models, in fact, encourage you to take on incremental risk, right? So it doesn't surprise me that we've seen that phenomenon. It really is the repeat of the Japanese story.
Or is it a Minsky story?
So that is the big question. That is certainly the big question. Okay, you know, what is unsustainable will prove to be unsustainable.
I'm not going to answer that question. It does worry me. I agree. Another thing that worries me is these money market funds. We only have time for one or two more questions, but I want to get this one in because it's a favorite of mine.
I want to reverse the question to you because you asked Anil. So would you do with money market funds?
I would probably want to shut them down. I think the business model going forward is not viable. Certainly in a period of negative interest rates, it's very difficult to see how these funds can survive. Maybe one should just let them go out of existence on their own. But let's face it, they were disruptive. And I said this in discussion with Anil, they were disruptive to the system in 2008, 2009. They were disruptive despite the efforts of the regulators. And the regulators put a lot of, I mean, certainly in Europe, but also in the United States, did what they thought was quite a lot to safeguard the money market funds and safeguard the system from disruptions in the funds. And nevertheless, in March, they were a problem. Why do we need this? And what are they good for, right? Some people say, the repo markets couldn't really function properly without the money market funds. That's the only story I've heard, really. What's your take?
So it's one of these things where, well, first, I don't think if you're really worried about them, right, you can't wait for it to happen naturally. Because if you're really worried about them, you're basically saying they're going to break the buck. That's what you're saying. Ultimately, why worry about them? And if you believe they're going to break the buck, that is systemic risk right there. And therefore, if you believe that that's the destination we're heading to, then you want to preempt what would be a whole bunch of disruption. Because I can tell you that too many people believe that that cannot happen. Remember what happened to the reserve fund in the 2008 crisis. I remember that Wednesday very clearly. Monday and Tuesday after Lehman was not as much of a disaster as now we think of it. It was the Wednesday and Thursday. And the Wednesday was the reserve fund breaking the buck and then AIG, right? Before that, it looked like, you know, well, maybe the policymakers knew what they were doing in terms of demonstrating that there was no moral hazard in the system. But it's really when the reserve fund and then AIG, people started realizing that the repercussion of what was going on was really significant.
Because you had two different kinds of counterparties. Before, you'd had just effectively one kind of counterparty that was in trouble. Now you had two more different kinds of counterparties that were in trouble. And you said to yourself, hey, this could happen anywhere. I don't want to deal with anybody. And so the system shut down. Well, we're going to have to shut down in a minute, but I won't do that before reading one. It's not a question. It's a comment from the audience, but I think I could echo it, saying, thank you, Dr. El Arian, for your insights. You are helping to focus the conversation while concurrently eliminating extraneous rubbish from it. I'm not sure whether that rubbish came from me, but maybe whatever, but certainly very focused. Always your responses in our discussion, always to the point. And we are extremely grateful for your participation in this event, which has just been a wonderful way to finish off what I think has been an excellent afternoon. And we're grateful too for your attentive participation during the afternoon and the points that you took out of the discussion, which I thought was a really powerful set of presentations and discussions in the entire event. So thank you very much, Mohammed, and I hope it will not be too long before we can actually see each other in person.
So let me thank you, and let me thank everybody who's organized it and everybody who's listening. I have taken, you know, lots of notes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I wouldn't have had the discipline to listen to the whole thing because I'm old, if it weren't for the fact that I knew that I was coming at the end, right? So thank you for providing the structural discipline that I needed. And everybody stay safe. Thank you.